from WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Neurologist Oliver Sacks is known for his remarkable stories about the quirks and complexities of the human condition. His books include Awakenings, which was made into a movie, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and Anthropologist on Mars, among others. Sacks's curiosity and generosity towards his patients and the people he writes about has helped the public overcome its own fears and ignorance about things like autism and Tourette's. Oliver Sacks has a new book, this one about himself. It's a memoir about growing up in London during World War II and his love affair with chemistry. It's called Uncle Tungsten, which was the nickname for a beloved uncle who manufactured light bulbs that were made of tungsten wire. Sacks writes about his intellectual adventures and his extended family of scientists. Sacks also suffered as a child. He was sent away to a boarding school during the war where he'd be safe from the bombs, but he was not safe from a sadistic headmaster and the bullies who made his life unbearable. Oliver Sacks has received a number of prestigious awards for his writing. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He lives in New York City, where he practices neurology, and joins us this morning on Radio Times. Nice to have you back.
Nice to be here again.
And to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Lines open for your questions or comments. I'd love to have you begin your visits to Uncle Dave's tungsten light bulb factory. And this is really how you begin your book. But help our listeners understand what it was like for a little boy to visit this factory.
Well, I was, as a little boy, for some reason, I was fascinated by metals. And I was full of questions about all sorts. And when my parents would do their best to answer them. And when I went too far, they said, well, you'll have to go to Uncle Dave to learn more. And we had called him Uncle Tungsten. He had this factory called Tungstellite, where he made bulbs. And I can still see him as I speak. He would often work at his lab bench, rather formally dressed with a wing collar, but with his hands blackened with tungsten powder. And the tungsten powder would be pressed and hammered and sintered and drawn into filaments for the bulbs. And I loved watching the bulbs being made. But Uncle also had quite a large laboratory of his own, and he inducted me into metallurgy and chemistry then when I was 10, when I came back from the boarding school. And he was also very fond of minerals, and he had luminous minerals in a cabinet. And he was very interested in the history of technology and chemistry. He had light bulbs going back to Edison's original ones, and he would tell me about the chemists in the 18th century who had first made tungsten. And so chemistry and technology was given a very human face.
Did he know he was called Uncle Tungsten by
the
family?
Oh, yes, yes, I think he quite liked that. There was another uncle, although I never knew him, who worked in a tin mine and was called Uncle Tin.
But he loved tungsten, and you describe going to the factory as a very sensual experience.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had bars of and ingots of all shapes and sizes, and he would love handling them and weighing them in his hand, and he would sort of thrust one to me, and he would say, "Feel it, Oliver. You know, nothing feels like sintered tungsten," or he would drop it and it would. I wish I'd bought a little bar today.
And
it would drop with a sort of strange clonk, and he would say, "You know, the sound of tungsten, nothing like it." And in fact, was partly being sent a parcel 4 years ago by a friend who knew something of my background, which contained a little bar which fell out with that clonk, which acted as a sort of Proustian mnemonic and brought Uncle Tungsten to life and started this whole unintended book off.
Well, you really come from a family of scientists. And in fact, you say that science was the kind of family businesses. But this goes back several generations and a very large family as well.
Well, my mother was the 16th of 18 children, and her father had come from Russia as a 16-year-old in 1853. And seven of his nine sons were interested in the physical sciences. And My mother originally wanted to be a chemist, but later she became a doctor and, in fact, a surgeon, a general surgeon, which was unusual for a woman at that time. The old man himself was an extraordinary mixture. He was sort of a grocer and a shopkeeper and a kosher slaughterer, but he was also a journalist, and he printed a newspaper in his basement. He was an inventor of lamps of all sorts. He was very interested in illumination. He was interested in aeronautics. He met the Wright brothers, and he was an amateur mathematician, apparently quite a good one.
So do you think we're seeing genes at work, or was there... Because there was a great deal of passion within the family, as
yes.
you write about it.
How much are genes and how much is the passion? I don't know, but... I still see now in the cousins and the removed cousins, the cousinhood is immense, but the sort of love of science and curiosity seems endemic among us.
Well, you were born in the early 1930s, grew up in London, and your parents were both physicians and had offices within the house. And again, you describe being a little boy and watching, I guess, patients go in and out or taking a peek through an open door and seeing medical equipment, which, of course, piqued your curiosity.
Yes. The office is called a surgery in England, and I would it was usually locked to me, but I peeked occasionally, and there was a wonderful sort of dispensary they had there with sort of coloured bottles of all sorts and apparatus and a microscope and my mother's anaesthetic bag. I took my first sniff of chloroform and ether from that.
On the sly, did
she
know?
No, I don't know. Well, she was very acute. She probably knew.
but I like, again, the kind of seamlessness between work and home. I mean, that work was so much a part of the family, that the office was in the home. But as a little boy, seeing parents' passions and their work, their interests all on display like that.
Yes, I think it's similar with me now. The work and home are interfused. I sleep in my office and do experiments in my apartment.
And eat the same meal every day? Is that correct?
I don't want to have to make decisions about that, yes.
So what do you eat every day?
I tend to have cereal at breakfast and lunch, and I tend to have rice and fish at dinner.
And you've been doing that for...
For 40 years.
For 40 years.
I mean,
hunger for spaghetti or something like that?
I go out quite a lot and sort of depart from that, although I really prefer my routine.
You grew up in a house that was full of music, it was full of books, not so much full of art, but it was actually decorated by someone who came in. Your parents, I guess, were not particularly interested in home furnishings, and so they hired someone to decorate the house.
No, they were completely indifferent. my father, there's an older sister of my father's, Auntie Lena, and they sort of gave her, when they moved into the house, they had lived in the East End of London, they moved in 1930, I think they sort of gave her a checkbook and said, do what you want.
So what did she do? What did it look like?
A good friend of mine said it looked like a rented house, but I was sort of outraged at that. There was sort of dilapidated, comfy furniture in some of the rooms, and rather formal furniture, which wasn't used much in the others. There were two pianos, and there were lots of tiny rooms as well with odd things. My mother had a knitting machine, which I was particularly fond of, and socks and gloves and things would be made. And there was a tiny triangular cupboard under the stairs, which became my secret room.
Where you could hide or you could observe others and not be seen?
Yes, and I also rigged up my own illuminating system for this, although I think that was a mistake because it was better obscure, and then one's imagination could explore it. And, of course, when I was older, I then developed my lab at the back. It was a disused washroom. It had windows and a sink. And it led right out into the garden. So if anything's boiled over or was about to explode, I could sort of rush out and throw it on the lawn. The lawn had already been half destroyed by incendiary bombs in the Blitz, and I sort of finished it off in 1943.
You had very tolerant parents, did you not? Or perhaps they were busy, or they just thought that Oliver would be okay?
I think they were remarkably supportive and tolerant, especially after I filled the house once with hydrogen sulfide, which is very poisonous. But they sort of just had a hood, a fume cupboard installed. And so long as I didn't go too far, which I may often have been on the point of going, they would go along. And I think they felt that they certainly didn't constrain me from having dangerous stuff. They felt it would sort of teach prudence or responsibility.
Mm. Did you like the danger of chemistry, of chemistry experiments?
Yes, I think I liked I like the sense that I might negotiate the danger and sort of have things under control.
And you did have some pretty extraordinary explosions and near mishaps.
Well, some minor ones. There were some. No, I'm almost unscarred myself. I am afraid at one point one of my brothers had his eyebrows blown off in a hydrogen explosion, and on the whole, not too much happened. I mean, now one can't have a laboratory like this now. I mean, so-called chemistry sets now have baking soda and vinegar and nothing in them. Come to think of it, you know, I had enough to do a lot of damage,
yeah.
But I didn't do a lot of damage.
What does that tell you then?
It tells me that we have too much of a nursery culture.
Well, you know, and again, reading your book, it almost sounded like you had a... I don't even know if I want to call it a Victorian upbringing, but it seemed very far away, very different from the kind of upbringing that the kids have today. Would you agree with that? Was it unusual, you think, even at that time? And it wasn't that long ago.
No, I'm you know, it was only 50 years ago, which doesn't seem much to me, although I know it will sort of seem unimaginable to people of 20 or 30. But a huge amount has happened. So much has happened in the last 50 years. I mean, even writing it, I always had the sense that I was describing a vanished epoch.
A kind of a different century, a different time.
Yes, yes. but certainly a time when a boy or a girl could have all sorts of wonderful hands-on adventures, whether they were chemical or mineralogical or natural history or botanical. Or electrical and optical. It wasn't just chemical for me. I loved taking batteries to pieces and doing optical experiments. And I don't think that a virtual world can really provide anything equivalent. Equivalent.
We have to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And our guest is Oliver Sacks. He has a new book. It's just been published. It's called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. And Oliver Sacks is a neurologist. He actually lives in New York City now, was born in London. And the book is about his adventures growing up. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about this and to take your calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We'll be right back. Oliver Sacks is our guest today on Radio Times. He has a new book. It's called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. His other books include The Island of the Colorblind, An Anthropologist on Mars, Seeing Voices, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, A Leg to Stand On, Awakenings, and Migraine. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, you, like a lot of children in London, or I guess in London during the war, the families were told or believed that they'd be safer off away from the bombing than they would be at home. How many children were
I think somewhere
evacuated?
Between 3 and 4 million, and parents were put under great pressure to, you know, and they often acted against their own, you know, feelings in sending children away.
Was it the government that suggested this?
Yes.
Or was it parental pressure?
No, it was the government's pressure on the parents.
And you were 6 years old at the time.
I was just six, yes.
And you were sent to a school called Brayburn.
Brayfield,
right. Excuse me. Which, I have to say, sounded like something out of Oliver Twist.
I think the headmaster, I think, was someone who had apparently been a decent sort of person, before the war, but I think maybe the war and being in total charge of a school went to his... Well, the... I think the headmaster, I think, was someone who had apparently been a decent sort of person before the war, but I think maybe the war and being in total charge of a school went to his head, and he became a little mad and rather sadistic. I mean, there's an old tradition of corporal punishment and beating in English schools, but whether this should be done with sort of 6 and 8 year olds, I don't know. And food was short, and there was a lot of bullying, and so it was a hell of a place.
What were you beaten for? What were you beaten for?
For anything.
You never knew.
Sometimes you knew. I mean, sometimes you would sort of coughed in prayers, or you sniffed, or you shuffled your feet, or whatever. And sometimes one didn't know. I mean, once he broke a cane on my 8 year old bottom and got very angry and said, "Look what you've made me do, Sax," and he added the cost of it to the bill.
You did something, though, when he was beating you, you used to say to yourself, it almost sounded like a mantra, "He's only Adams, he's only Adams."
Yeah.
How did that help you?
I somehow had to sort of, I think, almost take away his reality. Sometimes I would imagine him just as a sort of skeleton, and sometimes just as a sort of vertical mass of atoms. And I don't know, it somehow sort of defused things a bit. And I think I couldn't bear to really quite to face the intentionality of malice or cruelty or sadism.
So you sort of take yourself out of it in a way? Try to remove yourself from it.
Yes, and I had many other ways of removing myself. I became sort of fascinated by numbers. Especially prime numbers, which seem to me to be, you know, the first individuals in the world. I mean, they're the building blocks of numbers, and I felt they couldn't be hurt or suffer or be broken down and or alienated, whereas I was every day. And somehow I felt safe in, I imagined a sort of garden of numbers,
Well, let me just read a couple of sentences about this, and this is you writing, "I particularly love prime numbers. The fact that they were indivisible, could not be broken down, were inalienably themselves. I had no such confidence in myself, for I felt I was being divided, alienated, broken down more every week." So you could actually find refuge, haven in the sort of predictability, the constancy of numbers?
I think so. It was very important to feel there was something stable and invariant and uncapricious and unmalicious in the world. And numbers sort of had that role, as later sort of, I think, the elements did, and chemicals.
Well, you had an aunt who introduced you and sort of helped you understand this garden of numbers, that there could be this wonderful garden where you could...
This was also
mental
a very botanical aunt, and she herself was actually a headmistress of a school, a lovely school where all the kids had little gardens, but this was only for disabled kids in Manchester. But she used to show me the patterns on pine cones and sunflowers, and how these followed a particular series called a Fibonacci series. 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, you know, each number the sum of the two preceding ones, and she would say, "God thinks in numbers, and the world is made up of numbers," and somehow numbers and gardens became inseparably associated for me, as later sort of chemicals did.
And would you be a child that would be doing calculations and you know, while you were at the school?
Yes, I did sheets and sheets of calculations and making tables of primes, and I became good at mental arithmetic, and this was this was one of my withdrawals.
You had a brother there too, an older brother, Michael, who was at this school.
Yes, he was 5 years my senior. And he also had a very bad time, which I think became even worse when he went on to another school, a public school, when he was 13, where he was terribly bullied, and I think with dire effects. When I came back to London when I was 10, I remember an episode, I describe it, when Michael had come out of the bathroom and my Auntie Len, my botanical aunt, saw him half-stripped and said to my parents, you know, in his back was full of weals and scars and blows and bruises. And she said, "If what's going on?" She said, "If this is happening to his body, what's happening to his mind?" And indeed, after that, poor Michael sort of became psychotic and hallucinated and shouted and really had the sense that he was being tortured by what he called a flagellomaniac god, who even then seemed to me a sort of cosmic projection of our headmaster, our beloved headmaster. So in a sense, I felt what was going on in Michael. I think I felt many of the same feelings myself. I wondered if this was going to be my own fate, and I think this was one of the things which, in a way, made me go down to my little lab and almost block my ears and concentrate on experiments, on nature, on a safe area.
You even say that while at the school, you lost your own faith in God, or began to question religion, belief.
Yes, I certainly had a sort of, I think, a sort of childish religion. I came from quite an Orthodox Jewish family. I loved it when the Sabbath came in on Friday nights. I somehow imagined that Sabbath was a cosmic event, and that the peace of God would descend on star systems all over the universe. But I think, in a sense, I think I felt betrayed by my parents. I didn't realize, of course, that they were under pressure to send me away. And I think the, as it were, the breaking of trust in parents to some extent caused a breaking of religious faith.
And that's Oliver Sacks, our guest today on Radio Times. He has a new book. It's a memoir. It's called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Did you think you couldn't tell your parents, that you couldn't tell anybody what was happening to you and your brother?
I felt I couldn't, and I didn't tell anybody, and my brother Michael didn't, and most of the kids did and got removed from the school, and I think I finally ended up as the only person in the school, which was then closed.
And you just thought your parents, you didn't want to burden them, they wouldn't believe you?
I don't quite know what went on. I think I may have partly felt that this was a punishment and something I deserved, although what I had done was never clear, but I think sort of I think when things are inexplicable or not clearly explained to a child, then all sorts of fantasies are liable to take over.
That's what kids do to sort of explain a difficult, changeable, unstable world.
Yeah,
they come up with their own.
And these may be quite malignant sort of explanations, and the real one would be much more benign.
Although you do describe, and I guess it was a kind of a call for help, you came home to visit your family during a vacation, and you did something very uncharacteristic with the family dog.
I loved our dachshund Greta, but I sort of put her in the coal bin on an icy winter day, and she almost died of cold. I sort of confessed my crime at the last moment, and I was told off and given a good hiding, as my father would put it. But there was never any inquiry as to why I had behaved in such an odd fashion, although I think it was probably an oblique cry for help, saying, you know, I'm like the dog in the coal bin, help me.
But I wonder, I mean, could, as a little boy, could you have articulated that?
No.
No.
And I'm not even, you know, quite sure now whether it's the interpretation, but I would wonder.
Because it was out of character for you, right?
Yeah, very out of character. I was an odd child, but I don't think I was a monster.
And that's Oliver Sacks, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a neurologist and author of a new book. It's a memoir called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical boyhood. This school was closed down. Then you were sent to another school called St. Lawrence, which was not as I guess, a sadistic environment. But you weren't. It doesn't sound like you were that much happier.
No, I mean, in a strange way, I think I almost missed, as it were, the sadistic attentions of the headmaster. Perhaps I'd become habituated to them, because at least that was some sort of attention. I think I felt very isolated and out of place in this other school, and I started to sort of imagine different childhoods. I became a bit of a confabulator. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think this may also have honed the beginning of narrative powers.
Well, and also, when one looks at your work, so much of your writing is about people's heroism, in a way, overcoming the sort of adversity that's put their way. And one can see some of this in your own story.
Yeah. Yes, I think the predicament of the individual sort of faced with disease or misfortune or whatever is always my subject, and hopefully their ability to survive and even transcend, and perhaps even sort of find good in the experience or turn it to profit in some way.
And it sounds like chemistry, metals, tungsten did all of that. The periodic table did all of that. Prime numbers did that for you.
Yes, well, certainly I think they represented freedom and joyfulness and liberation and relationship. And I mean, this really was a passion, and it helped, I think, pull me out of the abyss.
And what you mean is a relationship between yourself and something else.
Yes, between myself and chemistry and the figures of chemistry whom I thought of as sort of as honorary uncles and aunts.
as if you didn't have enough already, right?
No, one never has enough.
you write with still, I guess, great passion about seeing the periodic table for the first time and being enthralled. And I have to say, because we're on the radio, that you have a T-shirt on with the periodic table right now.
And also,
he carries it in his wallet as well. and help us understand that. I mean, why it was such a magnificent...
Well, I mean, it's, by 1860 or so, something like 60 or 70 elements had been described. And although... of some local resemblances, some families were clear, no one had any idea how or indeed whether they were all related in a way. And it seemed to me a most wonderful achievement to see that they were all related, and that there was this sort of beautiful periodicity, so that at every eighth or ninth element you see the numbers come back. Yes. Certain properties recurred. And I didn't know whether the periodic table was something, as it were, in the heavens, like God's law, or whether it was a human construct. I'm still not sure, actually.
But what was intriguing was, or it sounded like what was intriguing was, that human beings, or a human being, could figure this out.
Yes. I mean, there was a great Russian, Mendeleev, who divined this and figured it out. And I think this was the first thing which gave me an intense sense of what the human mind, creativity, genius was about. It wasn't an easy thing for him. He probably thought of this for 20 years, although when it finally came to him, it came supposedly in a dream and almost like a revelation.
You know, I feel slightly awkward asking this, but it struck me as I was reading your book about a little boy so taken with numbers, about whether you also see that in autism, where a child or an adult will be so attracted to something and spend much of their day really focused on.
I've said I was odd but not monstrous. I think I was odd but not autistic. But certainly this was a a strange period, and there was probably less in the way of human interactions, although the uncles were very close to me. And as I say, there were these imaginary relationships, I had a very close imaginary relationship with Humphrey Davy and Boyle and others. And in a sort of way, I think it was almost like a preparation for human relationships of the right sort.
A sort of a long incubation period. Then,
yes. But 10 to 14, I think, can be a strange age before the storms of adolescence. You know, the psychoanalysts talk about a latency period. But I often think there can be an intense concentration and a sort of peace of mind at that age. It's a lovely age.
Did you have friends at this point? As you said, you had these uncles and your family.
Yeah. Not really. There had been one friend who was the same age, and we're still good friends. But I think it was only later, probably after the age of 14, that sort of friendships and in a way sort of more interactive and quote normal sort of behavior developed. Although I think I also felt that partly as a loss of this wonderful concentration and this, you know, and I think one's life tends to be a sort of balancing act between friendship and social activity and a sort of solitary preoccupation of one sort and another.
Were you a good student?
Sorry?
Were you a good student, a school student?
Yes and no. I was a terrible student in a way. I hated school. I hated sitting in class and having to take it. I hated exams. I hated competition. I loved libraries and I loved museums. I loved my uncle's factory. I loved the laboratory. I loved the botanical garden. I think I always wanted to have a sort of a direct, and if you want, rather privileged relationship.
Oliver Sacks is our guest today on Radio Times. He has a new book. It's a memoir. It's called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. And he joins us today on Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Oliver Sacks is our guest today on the show. He has a new book called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. Also the author of a number of other books, including The Island of the Colorblind, An Anthropologist on Mars, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, A Leg to Stand On, Awakenings, and Migraine. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's take a couple of calls, and I would like to talk actually about your parents. We have Paul, who's waiting on the line from Westchester. Hi, Paul. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. How are you
morning.
Doing?
I'm very well.
Good. Actually, it's interesting. I was listening earlier when you were talking about your childhood, and you were talking about playing with chemistry sets and that sort of thing. And I thought it was interesting, too, how you were talking about the modern day kids don't get to play with the same sorts of stuff.
Uh-huh.
I'm in my 30s, and I used to play with chemistry sets when I was, you know, I suppose it was in the 1980s and stuff. But I used to do the same sorts of stuff. I felt like I was listening to myself, you know, trying to make stink bombs and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
But I think what's really interesting is that I was very interested in the physical sciences when I was growing up, and for quite a while I was thinking about becoming a professional scientist, you know, as maybe a theoretical physicist or as a chemist, and I ended up becoming an engineer, basically because I didn't think I would be able to make a living as a scientist, and I didn't have enough guts to do it. But what I'm curious about is why Dr. Sacks decided to become a doctor rather than a physical scientist and, you know, to practice that profession instead.
Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, well, I certainly at one time wanted to become a chemist myself, although I think I wanted to become a 19th century chemist. I mean, I love the feel and the smell and the texture, and I think chemistry was, I had the sense that it was becoming too theoretical and too mathematical for me, whereas I think I'm a sort of naturalist by disposition, and I think this may have been one of the things which turned me finally from chemistry to biology and medicine.
Mm. And Paul, do I hear a little Irish?
Yeah, I'm
Scottish.
I'm from Ireland too, not too far from where the doctor's from.
That's right.
Thanks for calling in
okay,
Radio
thank
Times.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. And I guess just to sort of complete the story to some degree and to pick up on what Paul said, you went from a little boy completely in love with chemistry, and then, as you said, in this period between 10 to 14, or I guess at the end of that, beginning to feel as if a kind of a hunger, as you write, a hunger for something that was missing in your life.
Yeah, a hunger for the personal and for the organic and for music, very strongly for music.
And why do you think music?
It called to me in some deep way. It moved me as nothing else did. And it's very mysterious, and it continues to be mysterious. I see this power with everyone, but it was very important for me.
Did you not listen to a lot of music, and then in sort of early adolescence began to listen more intently?
I think more intently, and also to sort of read poems for their content and not their form. And so sort of the arts, at least the verbal and musical arts, became very important to me.
So did you outgrow chemistry?
It sort of faded inside me, or it seemed to, and to be replaced by other things. Mm. Although I must say, in writing the book, a lot of the joy and excitement has come back. And in fact, I filled my apartment and on office with experiments and with crystals growing and with spectroscopes and little cathode ray tubes and everything. I can't think about anything without wanting to relive it in a way.
But you also seem to say, and actually write about it with a great deal of humor, about sort of the sort of awakenings, I guess, that you had as a young boy, and sort of feeling the tug of your own sexuality and the tug of relationship.
Although I think this sort of took sort of sometimes odd forms, so that I became interested in the sexuality of various animals and plants. Of cephalopods, sort of octopuses and things, which have a very odd form of sexual intercourse, and plants. And I suppose there's a very sort of slow, cautious, indirect approach to sort of to oneself and to being human.
Sounds very like sublimation, yes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your parents, and then we'll get some more callers to join us. And about your father, you actually wrote said in an interview, he was a man who combined great timidity with great courage, also saying that's rather like yourself.
I can't stand up for myself, but I can stand up for my patients and my friends. And I think this was very much the case with him.
And you watched him? You watched him do that?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes the house would be taken over by sort of rather sort of gangster-like evangelists, and I think he was sort of helpless to keep them out. On the other hand, I would often go with him to house calls, and he would go to any extent to sort of protect a patient, support a patient, help a patient.
And he also seemed, and again, this seems like the kind of work that you do, he would see them in their own quote-unquote habitat. I mean, as a physician, was important.
He loved house calls, and he felt that he could never, it was never just a disease, but the disease was in a person, and the person was in a family and a culture. And he would sort of, everything would be taken into account. And I'm similar. I love doing house calls myself. And I think medicine is in very great trouble if it tries to confine itself to the clinic and the hospital. I think you have to have this sort of ecological, I don't know what term to use, sort of human sort of quality.
And to see the environment that somebody lives in.
To see it, and also to be part of it. And and to be in personal relationship.
Your father loved to swim, as you do.
Yeah, he was a swimming champ when he was a young man, and he sort of, in a way, threw us all in, the four of us, as babies, because
literally, you mean? Threw you in the water?
Yeah, literally, because when one is before the age of two, swimming is instinctive, and it doesn't have to be learnt. And, one makes swimming movements in the womb. And so, in a way, I find swimming more natural than being on land. And I really wish I could lead a sort of aquatic existence.
How often do you swim? How close to that aquatic existence do you get?
I usually swim every day. And when I can't swim, I wallow in the bath.
like that octopus that you captured, I guess, on a vacation and put in the bathtub.
Oh, yeah. It was a beautiful creature. Fisherman gave it to me, and I filled the bath with salt water. And we'd had cats and dogs, but I'd never had a pet of my own. And, you know, octopuses are very intelligent, and I thought affectionate. It would recognize me, I think, when I came, and it would flush different colors. I would feed it crabs. But then I had visions. I was going to build a great aquarium, you know, and give it corals and this and that. But one day the maid came in, saw it, had hysterics, poked it with a long broom, and the octopus discharged a huge cloud of ink and sort of died in its own ink. And I was very sad, and I took it back and dissected it sorrowfully.
Well, and speaking of dissection, your mother was a surgeon and thought nothing of bringing home things for you to dissect or even taking you to a lab to dissect a 14-year-old girl's cadaver.
I think my mother was also an anatomist, and she loved sort of the tissues of the body and the organs of the body, the organism. You know, like Barbara McClintock, I think there was a feeling for the organism. But what is natural for a professional adult may be rather traumatic for an 11-year-old boy. And when she brought home some of these pathetic little things and asked me to join her in dissecting them, it sort of gave me the horrors. On the other hand, you know, she was a woman, I think, of great warmth and charm. And sometimes I learn this indirectly. And I wonder if I can read you something.
I would actually love to have you read us something. And this is from Oliver Sacks' new book. It's called Uncle Tungsten.
My mother was an intensely shy woman who could hardly bear social occasions and would retreat into silence or her own thoughts when forced into them. But there was another side to her character, and she could become expansive, exuberant, a ham when she was at ease with her students. Many years later, when I took my first book to an editor at Faber's, she said, "You know, we've met before." I don't think I remember," I said, embarrassed. "I can never recognize faces." "You wouldn't," she rejoined. "It was many years ago when I was a student of your mother's. She was lecturing on breastfeeding that day. And after a few minutes, she suddenly broke off, saying, 'There's nothing too difficult or embarrassing about breastfeeding.' She bent down and retrieved a small baby which had been sleeping, concealed behind her desk, and unwrapping the infant, breastfed it before the class. It was in September 1933, and you were the infant."
That's a wonderful image, and what a wonderful story to be told.
Yeah. So I heard so many stories, good stories of my mother from her students and from her patients. She obviously came through as a very warm and sort of supporting and loving presence to them, although I think she sometimes seemed a little frightening to me.
Do you feel, though, that you are your parents' son?
Finally, I do. I think I may have had to write this book and to resurrect them and to resurrect the past to sort of feel this. But finally, I can sort of... there's no doubt about it. At one time, when I was very disturbed, I used to imagine that I had been brought up by wolves and possibly born of wolves, but now I know I was born of human beings and of my parents in particular. So there's been a great, I think, reconciliation here, and the book is partly a way of saying thank you.
Let's take a couple of phone calls here, and it's 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to join us today on Radio Times as we talk with Oliver Sacks about his new book. It's called Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood. We have Fran, and Fran's calling us from Voorhees, New Jersey. Hi, Fran, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. How
there.
Are you?
Fine.
It's an honor to speak with you, Mr. Sacks, as well as you, Marnie.
My
parents were from, they grew up right in the same time period. They were Jewish. They were in the East End. My grandpa owned Gold's Bakery in the East End, and I just want to know, A, did you know him, and B, could you talk a little bit about growing up Jewish in the East End? What was that like, just in general?
Thanks, Fran.
The picture.
Sure, right. Thanks.
My brothers were all born in the East End. When my parents moved in 1930 and I wasn't. But I would often go with my father to the East End. Now, I don't know whether he went to Gold's Bakery. But
wouldn't that be nice if he did?
but he loved the kosher restaurants there. And we would often go to different ones, and he would talk to the Costas, the Barrow boys in Yiddish. My father had been the Yiddish-speaking doctor of the Yiddish-speaking community there between about 1918 and 1930. He looked back on this with great nostalgia. It was obviously the realest part of his life. I'm sad in a way that that we didn't stay in the East End. There's a fascinating autobiography by John Gross called The Double Thread, and the double thread is being English and Jewish. And John's father was a doctor in the East End who stayed in the East End. There was once at a talk I gave, there was a strange question from the audience. Someone said, "Are you English or are you Jewish?" And I said, "Both." And he says, "You can't be both. You've got to be one or the other." Strangely, Robin Williams was in the audience. And when we had dinner afterwards, in a sort of an ultra English, ultra Jewish way, and with a great deal of Yiddish idiom, he showed how one could be both.
And we should say that Robin Williams actually played Oliver Sacks in the film version of Awakening. Someone actually wanted to know whether you know the status of some of the patients that you wrote about in Awakenings. Are you still in touch with them? That was written a long time ago.
No, I mean, they were already in their 60s and 70s, and the last one, died in about 1994.
Is that right?
Although she came along to the set and she did a scene with De Niro. Actually, when I was in England this summer, I met some wonderful old ladies in their 80s who had the encephalitis for 75 years. And so there are, this disease disappeared around 1930, but there are still a very few survivors.
Well, we only have a minute or two left, and I just wanted to read something that Paul Theroux had written about you. This was about a year ago in a magazine called Men's Journal, and it's actually you talking about yourself. Oliver is at ease working in the hospital, but says he's sometimes wary even there. He says he fears that one day he might become flustered at a hospital, and because of his stammering and shyness, he'll be confused with a patient and locked up. And this is you. "Without my badge and white coat, I am indistinguishable from many patients. In Bronx State, a state mental hospital I worked at, I always used to carry my white coat and my identity pass because I was never sure that if I lost it, I'd be able to prove my sanity." "Oh, yes, yes," he says, mimicking a sarcastic doctor, "delusions of being Oliver Sacks," which is a great. Were you being facetious, or do you honestly feel that way?
Well, there's a wonderful story of Chekhov's called Ward 6 about his psychiatrist who, as he becomes more and more sympathetic to his patients, becomes more and more an object of suspicion to his colleagues. I think it's not a real fear anymore, but I will try and move as deeply into my patients' worlds as I can while remembering that I am Dr. Sacks. Although there was one occasion in the past many years ago when I worked with some very disturbed and abused children, when I started to identify with them and forget that I was an adult and a physician. And identification is dangerous and it's no good. And I I got out of that.
It's no good because you can't help someone if you've over-identified with them?
Exactly, yes. You've got to be yourself with your adult abilities and perspectives.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
I've loved it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our guest has been Dr. Oliver Sacks. And again, his new book is called Uncle Tungsten, Memoirs of a Chemical Boyhood, author of many other books as well, including Island of the Colorblind, An Anthropologist on Mars, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, winner of the 2001 Governor's Award for Arts Leadership and Service.